session number 13459, reel 4.
Can I now move to the end of the war, and perhaps you could continue your story. When the war finished, what did you do?
Well, immediate recollections are we went on end of war leave until the powers that be could work out what they were going to do with all these thousands and thousands of aircrew. And after about 8 weeks leave or so, when I would receive a payment through the post every couple of weeks, I was posted to a place in Essex called Wethersfield, still on Halifax's, dropping paratroopers, towing gliders, training the glider pilot regiment people. We did that for a while, and then I went to Cramwell, where we operated two Halifaxes off the North Airfield, which was a grass airfield, and we were training the boy entrants at Cramwell in radio and radar. We would take half a dozen boy entrants up with us. These are the apprentices, ground tradesmen. We'd take them up on demonstrations of radio and radar, flying all round the coast of England, 5 or 6 hour trips. Then a stint at St. Athan as an instructor on the flight engineers course. 1950, I got married. And
when did you move over to Lincoln's?
1950. I moved from St. Athan up to Scampton on the operational conversion unit at Scampton on Lincoln's. I'd never flown. I'd flown Lincoln's for a few months at St. Athan on the training school. I'd never completed a course on the Lincoln. I picked it up as I went along. And as I was a staff instructor on the school, as if it was expected that I could fly anything as a flight engineer, which was grossly in error, because the Lincoln had Merlin 68A engines and the Halifax had Hercules engines. However, you picked it up as you went along, with the aid of pilot's notes, pilot and flight engineer's notes. And then I was posted to the OCU at Scampton on Lincoln's. And because I'd flown Lincoln's at St. Athan as an instructor, it was assumed that I could be a staff flight engineer at Scampton. So I was teaching the new lads on to the Lincoln, with my limited knowledge of Lincoln's, but always keeping one step ahead of the student. And then became very proficient, I suppose, on Lincoln's. Moved to the Bomber Command Bombing School at Lindholm in the early 50s, where we were doing bombing sorties all the time. We practiced 25-pounder bombs on bombing ranges up the Yorkshire coast and at Missen near Doncaster, an internal bombing range. This was training bomb aimers. Navigators and bomb aimers. I was just one of the crew that flew the aircraft from the front.
What was the policy for Bomber Command in those days? I mean, obviously, the Soviet Union become the enemy.
Right, yes.
And what was the strategy? I mean, you had the range capability to get the Soviet Union, did you?
Yes. In fact, one of the Lincolns was shot down while flying up from the south to the north, flying up over what would have been then East Germany, and he must have strayed off his track, and he was shot down by East German or Russian batteries. But we didn't think of war then. It was just a job. We'd been through the war. Where you were actually being shot at and what have you. Now it was just great flying around. And we had set exercises. obviously there was a potential, should we be needed, we could go in units and squadrons. I mean, all the Lincoln squadrons around Lincolnshire, Hemswell and Upwood and Bimbrook and Waddington and places like that, all had their various Lincoln squadrons with weapons, with man turrets, with ammunition in, and bomb dumps and things like that.
How did it compare with the Halifax? Did you have a seat this time?
Yeah, I had a seat this time.
From the station.
I flew with a dual control beside the pilot. And we would go up for 2 hours and drop a couple of dozen 25-pounder bombs with the two UT under-training bomb aimers that we had with us. And, for instance, we'd go to Theddlethorpe off the Yorkshire coast, or Donnanook was another target. These would be targets set out on the sands and in low water, which we would strive to hit. And the higher you could bomb, the better would be the accuracy, because if you bomb, you were limited by the height you could climb to bomb on the exercise because of cloud. If you were going to fly on Monday, for instance, with these two under-training bomb aimers, and it turned out on Monday that the cloud base was 10,000 feet, you could only bomb 10,000 feet. And the error of the bombs that were dropped would be calculated backwards as if they were dropped from 20,000 feet. So the error would be compounded. So you always strive to get as high as you could so that you'd have less error. Because the first one that you threw down, if it was a quarter of a mile away from the target, you could make the necessary adjustment to get them onto the target. So we always liked to bomb as high as possible. And it was always a rat race getting airborne out of Lindholm to make our way to the target, to get there first, to get the radio call to fix your height to bomb from.
Well, the performance of the Lincoln was a dramatically increased.
Oh yeah, very much so. And we had a dual control there, and as flight engineers, we would fly the aircraft to the target, and we would do the teardrop pattern. All bombing exercises were teardrop, where you fly outbound and come back in on a reciprocal, left, steady, steady, bomb gone, fly out, do a teardrop, come back in on a reciprocal, left, steady, steady, bomb gone. And you drop them all like that. Once you drop your bomb, back home and shut the aircraft down and away.
Was it a quieter aircraft? Was it more insulated? Or?
No, it wasn't any quieter. I mean, there were no pressurisation. There was no pressurisation or anything like that.
What about heating? Did you have heated flying
suits? No, we didn't have heated flying suits. Rear gunners had heated flying suits. They could plug into the aircraft electrical supplies. We had full flying kit. Because at 20,000 feet, the temperature can be minus 30, minus 20. We had gloves. We'd have a silk liner glove. Then we'd have a chamois glove. And then a woolen glove. And then the heavy gauntlets. Flying boots, heavy flying socks. Big, thick, black, heavy pullover, or a big white pullover. Then your battle dress jacket, and an outer flying suit, and then your harness, and you were fairly warm.
And you'd be on oxygen, I suppose.
On oxygen, yeah. Anything above 10,000 feet would be on oxygen. And the heating was ducting around the engine exhausts, which heated the air and came along through ducting pipes in the aircraft, and you had a little grill that you opened or closed. It used to get cold.
I suppose all those aircraft carried loos, very basic loos, didn't they?
There was a toilet down the back, yes, yeah. An Elson toilet. Mm. And all crew stations had a bottle that you could pee into. And
that was on the Halifaxes as well?
Yes, yeah. And the skipper would always, he would always be passed a bottle to pee into the bottle. And then getting rid of it was the problem. Putting it down the window chute. All wartime aircraft had a chute, had two chutes, a flare chute for bomb release and another little chute that you've heard of, window, which is like tinsel paper, like silver strips of silver foil. That would all be done up in bundles. And when you're approaching the target area, you drop a bundle out about every 30 seconds. Just break the seal on it and then drop the bundle down the chute. And all that would disperse in the air, presumably to interrupt enemy radar. I mean, you often see it on TV screens where it's all like a snowstorm. That is interference. Well, that would how it would affect enemy radar, so we're told. And that's where the skipper's bottle would be poured down there, invariably. But I've never known the skipper get out the seat to go back to use the toilet in earnest, although other crew members have. This captain, this skipper, Bill Steele, that I flew with on one trip they were on, they had a hit, and the bomb aimer was actually on the toilet, and they were hit. Completely smashed the Elson, and Bill, the bomb aimer, he finished up with the seat laying across his chest. When he came to, he was covered in everything that was in the Elson, all the not so much business that people had passed, but all the Elsinore fluid and all the rest of it, the disinfectants and chemicals, he was covered in that, and this seat was laying across his chest. Humorous at the time. Anyway, going back to Lincoln's, Bomber Command Bombing School, and then the Lincolns were going to be phased out, and one of the biggest mistakes I made in my life then, in my Air Force career, we were all going to be posted to the Hastings at Lynham on the transport squadrons, and we'd heard so many stories about the transport squadrons, the good life down the route to India and Singapore and Australia. When the postings officer rang up and said he wanted two flight engineers to go to boats, that were Sunderland's flying boats, nobody volunteered because we'd all heard about the good life. And eventually, two of our men were posted to Pembroke Dock down in Wales on Sunderland's, and they were so upset about this. In later years, when the Sunderland's were declared obsolete, both these men, a chap called Peter Scott and another one called Jock Glass, were posted back to the Hastings, and I met up with them again. And they said it's the best time they've ever had in their life flying the old Sunderland flying boat. And different friends of mine know, when I speak to them, I find that they've been on Sunderland's. And they all talk about a wonderful time. And I do regret not volunteering going on to the Sunderland, because it would have given me another aircraft type, and I would have come back to the Hastings anyway, at a later date. Then I did about, from 54 to 67, about 13, 14 years on Hastings transport. Culleran, and Lynham, and Changi at Singapore for 2.5 years with my family.
That's Culleran, not Cologne, isn't it?
Yeah, Culleran. Colerne, the other side of Chippenham Way, on the way to Bath, between Chippenham and Bath.
Yeah.
Cullen, the locals call it.
Did you enjoy the Hastings?
Oh, very much so, yeah. Yeah, we used to call it the Queen of the Skies. That was its nickname. Whereas the Hercules that I went to in 67, when we first got the Hercules, I stayed with them from 67 until 83, that's nickname. The Hastings was Queen of the Skies, and the Hercules has always been known as Fat Albert. Mm. Wonderful airplane. So versatile. This is the Hercules I'm talking about now.
The Hastings, to get out to Singapore, how many stops did you have to make down the line?
That would be a 9-day trip. We'd go to Castle Benito, later called Idris, in North Africa, near Tripoli. Then across to Habania, in Iraq. Then Maripur, India, Karachi. And then Negombo, 11 days, sorry, Singapore. Negombo in Ceylon, Sri Lanka, and then Singapore. So that was CB, Habania, Maripur, Negombo, Changi. So it took 5 days to get there. You had a day off, and then 5 days back, 11 days. Whereas the Aussie trips would take 16 days. Once you got to Singapore, then across to Darwin and Adelaide or Sydney.
You were flying what, mainly cargo?
Mainly cargo. We would have passengers as well. We used to carry families around, people on postings to the Far East or to India. We'd have wives and kids on board as well. But in the later years, it was mainly cargo.
So the personnel tended to go on charters, didn't
they? Yes, yeah. Very interesting life on the Hastings.
So that brings you now to Lynham and your last posting. Was it on the Hastings?
Well,
how did that happen?
In my time on the Hastings, I would go between Cologne and Lynham and what is called the examining unit, the Transport Command examining unit, where select personnel are posted to the examining unit, and then they become examiners of all Transport Command aircrew. And I had two tours on that on the Hastings, and then I had two tours on that on the Hercules. But my airplane, Hercules, all operated out of Lynham, and a few down at the Thorny Island, at the Operational Conversion Unit, the Thorny Island. I would be responsible for examining those flight engineers at Thorny Island, all staff instructors, examining them on the ground and in the air on route checks. And the same with the Lynham base crews. It was at Lynham that I achieved 10,000 flying hours, and I came back off a trip with 24 Squadron, and we'd been out to Bermuda or somewhere. And on that time, while we were actually on the way back, I actually reached 10,000 hours, which is quite a landmark in military flying. I know it's nothing for civil aviation, but military flying is quite an achievement. And the skipper sent a signal off to say that at such and such a latitude and longitude, Squadron Leader Wixon, at the altitude of 26,000 feet, at such and such a time, achieved 10,000 flying hours. And when I arrived back at Lynham, to my surprise, there was about 30 people from the squadron, including the wing commander, all to meet me and present me with a bottle of champagne, and they lifted me off the aircraft, because invariably I was the granddaddy of any crew that I flew with. A lot of crews used to call me Uncle Bill. They lifted me off the aircraft, plonked me in a wheelchair, wheeled me through customs, and a customs officer stepped forward, and they said, he's got nothing to declare, he's going to a party. And they pushed me past customs, and the customs officer came running after me, and he gave me a right rollicking for trying to evade going through customs. Now, whether he was part and parcel of the act, I don't know, but I felt quite put out with the ticking off he gave me. And somebody took pictures of all this, and I looked quite concerned while the customs officer was waving his finger. And then over to the squadron, and there was a reception in the squadron with a presentation again and a history of my flying and all the rest of it. And we had a wing-ding party there and then. And then I reached the age of 55, when one normally retires. And I was doing a staff tour at Uphaven then, flying a desk, you might say, as training engineer, responsible for all the training programs for flight engineers. And I was asked by MOD, because of an acute shortage of pilots and flight engineers, they'd been asking older people to stay for another couple of 3 years while they could get over the tide of training replacements. And I refused on the grounds that I thought that I'll stay for another 3 years, I thought they'd keep me at this desk. But they asked me a second time and I refused again. And when I was asked a third time, within about a couple of 3 months, I said, I will stay for another 3 years, provided you can guarantee that when I finish my tour behind this desk, I'll be returned to flying. Because it's all too easy once a chap's behind a desk and is in the know of how to run that office, the tendency is to keep him there. And they assured me I'd go back to flying, and they said, in fact, you'll go back to your examining duties. So I said, yes, I'd accept, and I stayed to the age of 58. So I was back on flying, and I saw my time out still flying, operational flying. And it's been a very pleasant life. Lots of living out of a suitcase, especially in the transport days. From the sort of mid-50s on, for the last 30 years of my service, I did 40 years, the last 30 years of my service, it was living out of a suitcase, going here, there and everywhere. But it was most enjoyable. In the meantime, you try to raise a family of two boys and a girl. It's been an enjoyable life.
Do you have a favourite period that you enjoyed most?
I enjoyed my tour in Singapore on the Hastings, thoroughly enjoyed that. I mean, it was a lovely way of life. The different theatre that we were operating in. For instance, we would take an aircraft laden with passengers and a bit of freight or all passengers up to Hong Kong to rotate families and take in cargo, to rotate Gurkha regiments and things like that. We take those from Singapore, from Changi up to Hong Kong. And there was no way we could get to Hong Kong in a direct flight. We had carried insufficient fuel to get that far with prevailing winds. So we'd have to call in at Saigon and pick up fuel. And remember that the Vietnam War was in full swing while we would go into Saigon. And we would go in, and there would be C-130s, 141s, Phantoms, aircraft of all sorts, choppers, hundreds milling around all in the Saigon area. And we'd just come in with our RAF Air call sign, and we would land and pick up fuel, and more or less say, oh, that's nothing to do with us, we're British, we're not in the war, you know, you carry on, do what you want. And then we would get airborne out of Saigon. Sometimes we'd have to wait as much as 3/4 of an hour to an hour on the taxiway before we could get airborne because of all operational aircraft in and out and sort of taking precedence over you on takeoff. They would taxi past you and get airborne. Sometimes aircraft would have to call back and say, well, I can't make my destination Hong Kong now with my fuel reserves. Got to go back and refuel and pick up another 100 guns.
You were the only gasoline customer there, weren't you?
Well, there were a few American aircraft with gasoline, yeah. Or Avter, like the C-130s. They're not gasoline, they're turbine aviation fuel, a refined paraffin. But mostly they were jets, and they can't hang around on taxiways for long. They've got to get airborne, otherwise they don't complete their mission. And we climb up out of Saigon and eventually coast out and up to Hong Kong. On the way back, we could go back direct because of invariably got a tailwind, so we could make it. Oh, yeah, I did enjoy the Singapore time.
Now, the Borneo bandit campaign was going on
there. Yes, right? Yes, it was.
You were involved in that, obviously.
Yes, yeah.
Can you tell me?
We had two bases, air bases in Borneo. We had Kuching, and which was Sarawak, and then there was Labuan Island just off the coast, and We were involved in the Borneo confrontation against Indonesia. And we, as the transport force in Singapore, were supplying and supporting the troops on the ground. Flying in, for instance, artillery, we'd have a cargo of howitzer shells, and we'd fly those in. And we would drop those by parachute on different DZs, drop-in zones in the Borneo jungle, all pre-arranged. And they would go out on the roller conveyor, on the Hastings, they had a roller conveyor going down the fuselage, and the cargo doors would be off, and the roller conveyor would twist through 90 degrees and shoot the platforms out the side door and drop by parachute. And we drop those, then we would drop live chickens to the Gurkhas, the Gurkha regiments there. Live, all sorts of things would be all crated up. The Gurkhas would never eat any meat that had been killed. They had to kill their own meat. We would drop crates and crates of beer to the Aussies, pallets of beer. The Aussies couldn't drink their beer without ice, so we'd have to drop pallets of ice, all in a sort of wartime situation. Sounds daft, doesn't it? Dropping ice for the Aussies to drink their... I don't know whether they had Foster's there, Castlemaine or what, but couldn't drink the beer without the bloody ice, mate.
And I suppose your family were out in Singapore with
Yes, you? Yeah. And strange enough, my son was in the Air Force at that time, and he was posted to Kuching. I used to go to Kuching about a couple of times a week and take him a food parcel from Mum back in Singapore. Would be continually on to him to house his education, because he was an airman in the Grand Wireless Trades. How's the education going, Russell? Because I wanted him to get his O-levels and things like that to remuster to aircrew, because I could see that my life had been so interesting as aircrew. I mean, I went through the ranks as a sergeant, flight sergeant and warrant officer, master aircrew, through the commissioning side. And I could see him staying as an airman, as a junior technician, all his time. But if he remustered aircrew, he'd go successful training, he'd go straight to sergeant, and life begins anew when you're in the sergeant's mess. And he would give me all sorts of excuses about not enough books and not enough chairs in the classroom, or this course was oversubscribed, and I thought, this is a load of bullshit. And I went in one day and I phoned up his education officer. And I spoke to this squadron leader and I said, oh, have you got a J.T. Wixon on your books, I said, for education? Hang on a minute, he said. No, he said, what section's he? I said, Graham Wireless. Oh, he said, are you his flight commander? I said, no, I'm his dad. I'm coming in from Changi with the Hastings, I said, and I keep trying to get him some education, but he tells me that you're full up with classes. What bullshit, he said. I'll see to this. So he started education classes, but he never achieved the necessary qualifications to even consider remustering to aircrew, and he finished 12 years as a JT, junior technician. He's now a policeman at Salisbury.
You've got another son?
Sadly I lost the other boy just after we came back from Singapore in 67, and he was killed riding pillion on a motorbike up at Lynham in Friday the 13th, September 68. Terrible day, Friday the 13th. I've had no association with fear of Friday the 13th, but lots of people do have, and it upset my wife terribly that our boy should be killed on Friday the 13th. And I have a daughter. She lives at Freshbrook near here, about 2 mile away, 2.5 mile away. She married a flight lieutenant pilot at Lynham, a Hercules pilot. They were married for about 14 years. And then he had an affair with her best friend and went off with this best friend, and they subsequently divorced, and she's remarried now. And she has 2 children. From her first marriage. So, with my daughter at Freshbrook, just outside Swindon, and my son at Salisbury. Betty and I intended, when I came out of the Air Force, that we would go to Yorkshire to retire, because we'd done so much time in Yorkshire at Lindholm and my war service, and then 3 years at Dishforth outside of Ripon. We liked the Yorkshire people, and we decided we'd settle in Yorkshire. But when we lost Michael in that motorbike accident, he's buried in Lynham Churchyard, we thought, well, we can't move away to Yorkshire and leave Michael here. So I bought a house here in Wootton Bassett, and then for the next 10 years, I went backwards and forwards to work in uniform from a civilian house. And in retrospect, I'm glad I did buy, well, it's 20 years ago now, I bought the house at 10,500, which ultimately went up to about 80,000. So staying here has meant that we've spent all these last years backwards and forwards to Michael's grave, and my wife would attend to it every week religiously, until about 2 years ago, and I said, well, I think after all these years we could cut it down to once a fortnight. And sadly now I've lost my wife, and she's buried in the same grave with Michael. The grave digger was contacted, and he said Michael's grave was deep enough to take Betty's casket. So she's in with him.